You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello there and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. And this next interview was recorded in my hotel room in Wellington, New Zealand, during the New Zealand International Comedy Festival. This is an excellent comedian with a flair for language and also the sort of act who bestrides both the well-written longer show format and properly smashes up comedy clubs. He's a very funny man, and I think you're going to... I was going to say dig him. Why was I going to say that? Because he dresses like he has just walked out of Yellow Submarine. This is the brilliant Tom Wrigglesworth.
Is that yours?
Yes, it is. It's a little thing that plugs into your computer to act as a little speaker.
For you. Oh, Bluetooth speaker. Very nice. Had my eye on one for a while.
Yeah, it's nice, but don't buy that one because that one requires a Bluetooth transmitter that plugs into your laptop, though your laptop's got Bluetooth.
Oh, God. It's maddening. No, I mean, you can't beat a wire in these. Yeah, I mean, Bluetooth's all well and good, but just wire it in. Anyway, sorry.
That's all right. Let's talk about... we're here in Wellington. How's your run been in Wellington? You were saying last night you're having difficulties with the room.
I've got a room that is designed to make it hard. Like, if it was a crazy golf course hole, which we've been on today, it would have a windmill, massive U-bend, one of those sort of things that chomp the ball up.
And let's be specific, what elements of it make it hard? Why is it hard?
Well, there is no seat in the venue that faces the stage.
Yeah.
So straight away you're compromised.
So it's all painter's tables, isn't it, with people like,
yeah,
lengthways?
Yeah, it's like trestles that you do wallpapering on.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're really long and thin, and they're perpendicular to the stage, so they, you know... So everyone's side on. Everyone is side on. In fact, half the audience has, if they were sat at the table, would have their back to you.
Mm.
Only the table directly ahead of you is truly side on. Everybody else is, you know, half of them are three quarters looking at you and a quarter away, and then the mirror image the other. It's just a mess. So, and the stage is really high, really high. Like, above, my feet are above the front row, which is, I don't like that sort of thing. The floor's wooden. I mean, that's not a thing weird, but if anyone moves about, it just gets clackety-clackety-clackety-clack.
Yeah.
You can't see anything, which a lot of people like, but I kind of like to see a little bit. You can't see anything...
You can't see anything at all, can you?
Yeah,
no.
Nothing at all.
How did you find it different? Given that your show at the moment, the show you're doing here is utterly at odds with the universe, which has theatrical elements to it and recorded voice elements and is a sort of heartfelt story as well as containing lots of stand-up. We'll talk a bit more about that in a minute, but... How do you feel perform? Like, we both also did the Late Show gig last night in the same room. It was packed with people, and we were doing, you know, club sets. How did you feel that differed? Did you feel it still had the same problems, or are they specific to the fact that you're trying to do something a bit different in your show?
I think a late show is fine in there when it's rammed and drunk and moving about is tolerated, really. And the dynamic's different, really, because you're just a sort of shouty comedian doing 10 minutes. So it's easy to be great, and it's easy to ride roughshod over the problems. But when you've got to talk for an hour at 7 o'clock, and if it's only half full, it's got a very strange shape to it, so it needs to be... Like some places, you can they might hold 150, but if you have 40 or 50 in there, it's absolutely fine, but this isn't one of them. I mean, this is just another reason. This is another windmill on the greater golf hole. It's another insurmountable obstacle. If a critical mass isn't reached, it shows, and it did. So I had two shockers. One good one, two shockers, one good one.
Now, the one I saw was one of the, in your terms, shockers.
Yeah, that was the lowest of the lowest, yeah.
Why? What? In what regard?
For all of the reasons I've said, and critical mass wasn't reached, so... And I'd not quite struck the balance of trying to politely say to the audience, please don't get up and go to the toilet. I'm not being sensitive. I don't care if they miss a bit. How could I care if they miss a bit? Like, I don't care if the audience misses a bit. If one person misses one joke, that's nothing to worry about. But I always make a mistake. If people move about and...
You get rattled. Off,
I get rattled. I will then slip a word up and think, oh, I've messed up. And then I'll mess up again because I was thinking about that. And before I know it, the whole gig is nosediving. And it's all stuck down to just the fact that someone put me off.
It's interesting because I saw those little... I know we're talking... Well, as I said, it's a very specifically written show. You described the show as 10,000 words that detonates over 60 minutes.
Yeah.
It was very... Oh, wow. Phone, that's the actual...
That's the landline. It'll be PPI. PPI.
Excuse me. Hello?
Amazing chat there with Sophie, the festival representative, festival coordinator here in Wellington, during which she used the phrase sweet as 3 times.
Oh, yeah.
New Zealand Fair. Yeah. It's 10,000 words. It detonates over 60 minutes. And it's a scripted piece. Yeah. So what I observed was when you were thrown, you seemed to me to throw yourself more than you were thrown by the event.
Yeah.
And when you said, oh, it takes a nosedive, from the perspective of an audience member, I was thinking, this isn't a nosedive, this is fine. Something's distracted you and there we are.
Yeah, I know it's much worse in my head, but I can't... I want to do it like... I sometimes come off going, that was really good, I made 3 minor errors.
Yeah.
Like driving, that passed the driving test, that was 3 minor faults. That was like 2 scuffs of words and a pause that was longer than I should have done. And I thought, oh, that's fine. But a major error is obviously forgetting a bit and having to, or like what I've done a few times, which I'd probably describe as a major error, is if you accidentally, I don't like punchlines with a word that you've said in the setup. I never hear like hearing that. I always think it sounds really clumsy, unless it's a sort of repetition type situation where through repetition it's funny. Obviously that's different. But if you're talking about like a friend or something like that, you can't then say friend in the punchline, I don't think. So I'll always just use synonyms in the setup. And then there'll be a point when I'm in the setup and I've realised that I've used the word from the punchline. So I'm now having to go, right, I need a synonym for...
So you're trying to look through the Rolodex to find a synonym to replace.
And I'm going to have to say chum, or I could say chum's a bit weird. I'll say pal. I'll say mate. And then you approach it all comes too quickly and you end up saying cham. Yeah. You end up saying a mixture of the words that you'd auditioned, and that's a major error because now you're just making up words, so that won't do. So that and that sort of thing can put me. That, if people move about too much, I get rattled. That's the classic example of what
happens. Does that happen in your club sets?
Not really, no, because it's a different. I feel different. I feel more aggressive and more. It's more of an instant explosion, really. Whereas I think the longer shows, I mean, I do try and explode in the right bits, but it's more of a sort of a long burn.
Mm.
Kind of, it's like charcoal rather than TNT. And if over 8 minutes, you can just go. Like, I was touring this show in the UK, right? And in the UK, it was 85 minutes long or something like that, with an interval, so 40 and 40, and a bit of fluff either end. And then I went to Sydney and I was just doing 5 minutes gala spots and it was like asking kind of, it'd be like asking a professional footballer of, you know, fairly good standard to just kick a ball in an empty penalty, not even take a penalty with a goalkeeper there, just kick the ball into penalty. Of course they're going to do it. So 5 minutes, it was so easy, it was such a breeze, and you could just say, you just go on.
I thought that's, so that's a curveball. I thought you were going to say, I found it really hard, no, because I was doing 85. No,
you just go on and explode, you just go on and go right.
Yeah,
5 minutes and then it's time to go. I mean, yeah. All you've kind of said is hello and a few.
You specialise, it seems to me, in your tour shows at the moment, your Edinburgh shows and your touring shows, as over the last few years you kind of morphed into someone who tells a story which contains stand-up elements. But when you started out, obviously, as many of us do, you were doing kind of pure stand-up, sort of observations, you know, stories, but smaller stories. So you were, it's funny, I was just looking back over something just to jog my memory. I remember in one of your reviews it pointed out you used to do songs as well. I remember you having a song in common with Izzy Sutty, did you? The IKEA song?
Yeah, we wrote it together.
You wrote it together and then you both used it on the circuit, which I always thought was really charming.
And we did it, we used to do it as a duet where possible.
Oh, really?
It was written as a duet, yeah.
Oh, I never saw it as a duet, okay.
Yeah.
But so let's talk about the origins of your stand-up. How did you get into pursuing stand-up?
And
I appreciate you may have told this story several times before, so we don't need to
linger
over it.
That's no problem. Like, I kind of got annoyed with people telling me to try it. That's not strictly true. Like, a load of people kept saying, you should do that.
You should try stand-up.
Yeah. And then I used to go and watch it a lot in Manchester. That's where I used to go and watch. And
the Store or the Excess?
I don't know if the Store was there even. It might have been. The Frog and Bucket was the sort of. They used to have student nights and things like that. So I used to go there. And who was? Like, Peter Kay was just starting to be big in Manchester. This was 98, I think. Yeah, it was 98 when I started watching. Before that, but anyway. And people used to just say, you've got to try it. And I never had the bottle, you know, and I was never told by my parents that that sort of thing is possible. Like, that. I was never given any sort of theatrical encouragement.
Sure.
So I didn't bother. I just got a proper job. And then what happened was I met a man called Sean James, who people will know of. And we met just at the Banana Cabaret in Balham, where I used to live near there, and we used to just go and watch. And he's a bit of a sort of Pied Piper of entertainment. He has a phenomenal mailing list.
Okay.
And he's always sorting stuff out. So if you just, like, it's really weird. You get an email from him, you go, oh yeah, I really like that band, I'll go and watch. And you turn up, and, like, I saw it a couple of times where people would know someone and they didn't know they were going as well.
Mm-hmm.
Such as Sean.
Mm-hmm.
Sean's wide casting net of mailing lists that sort of mutual friends would arrive unbeknown to each other. Going, oh God! And so he did a comedy course, and then he said to me, "You should just." And it just got to the point where I've got to try it just to. You know, regret is a horrible thing, isn't it? Regret is one of the worst feelings.
What were you planning to be before you... Were you planning to be anything? Did you have life... Did you have aspirations?
Really, no, I used to just... No, I was really naive and I thought I'd be young forever and everything. And just thought, like, that, you know, marijuana is brilliant.
Yeah, right.
So that sort of nulls any long-term plan.
Sure. So your first gig, do you remember what your material was when you finally succumbed to the pressure?
I recited a hilarious take on... I used to propose... You know when you get a big lorry that moves, a heavy goods vehicle,
mm-hmm.
HGV, right? And the one where the back can come off,
mm-hmm.
and you're left with that front bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to suggest how it looks like Scrappy Doo, like the little version without the big one. And then I used to make the thigh slapping observation that the massive cables that come out of the back can only be connected to a huge phone. You know, you get the massive spongy coil cables.
Yes, at the back of a truck. Oh yes,
the join. I presume it's for the lights or something.
Yeah,
but they look like phone.
Okay, I like the curly phone cable. Yeah,
yeah. I used to do
this. I feel like this is sort of, this could become a new segment on the show. Is painfully talking through your first routine.
That was a favourite. I used to do something about which I've seen and heard other people do since, or you know, which means it's good. And it was about how when I phone home, my dad, doesn't matter how long it's been, my dad just hands a phone to my mum every time.
Mm-hmm.
I just, and I think my sort of punchline was when Terry Waite finally got out, if he phoned home and said, "Dad, it's me, Terry." And he, "Oh, hello, Terry, I'll just get your mum." Incarcerated for years.
Were these jokes that you had written before going on, or were they things you'd said conversationally with your mates and thought, "Oh, that might work"?
Probably said conversationally, actually. Yeah, yeah. And then I tried to write down. Yeah.
And how did it go?
It went quite well, actually. I remember the fourth gig I did was to silence.
I mean, that's par for the course. I think people tend to have a good couple of first ones and then a shocker. A
fairly reasonable introduction. I mean, I've been booed off several times.
Have you really?
Yeah.
Have you for why specifically? I've never talked to anyone about that phenomenon before. I've been bottled on once at a street festival, but I've never been booed off.
I've been booed off up the creek when I wasn't very good, and I was in the middle. And the problem was they had a gig in Croydon and a gig in Greenwich, and so you got two good acts that went on first at one and then last in the other, and then the middle act just stayed in one venue.
Mm-hmm.
And wasn't as good, and it was in Croydon, and at Croydon up the creek was a bit like, it was no art centre. It makes this gig I'm doing here in Wellington look like a dream. And I had to go on after Jeff Innocent, who was so good and so cockney and so what they wanted.
Yes.
That anything that wasn't that, which I was the absolute opposite, northern, big hair, weird, everything that he wasn't. They started booing. Stupid, there's no way. And I've been booed off twice in one night, which is probably,
that's some sort of record.
Yeah, that might be a record. I've spoke to a few people and they reckon it might have happened at Jonglers in Battersea when they had two shows there.
Mm-hmm.
It was possible. No one remembers it, but there's a horrible gig in Covent Garden that will remain sway. And there's an upstairs and downstairs of this place. And I got booed off. This one of them's notably easier than the other.
I've heard that, yes.
The downstairs is harder, I think. I got booed off downstairs. And Mike Gunn loves telling people this story. Because I got booed off. He loved it. And he went, I was saying to Mike, I just don't know what happened. He said, well, at least that was a harder one. We've got to, you know, the easier one's next, right? So we went off, had some coffee, came back. Went upstairs, got booed off again. And I swear blind, I tried my hardest. I was not trying to get booed off. I was trying to be really funny, and they hated me so much.
When I hear that someone's been booed, when I hear that you have been booed off, part of me sort of almost respects it out of kind of, oh, well, you see, that's Wigglesworth. You see, he's uncompromising. He does his thing, and if they don't like it, they don't like it. Part of me kind of is excited by that. Do you think that was the problem, that you were uncompromising? Did you have other gears that you didn't use? Did you not have other gears?
I had other gears that I used, but it made it worse. Like once it started to go, I mean, I have done it. I have just died in peace before as well.
And I feel like we're starting this interview in a very negative kind of way. Just for the benefit of the listener, if they're not aware of you, you are a well-respected headliner managed by the Comedy Store. You know, these are definitely the exceptions rather than the rule. I'm always thinking there might be someone in, you know, Canada listening to this, or, you know, somewhere you've not been going, why are you talking to this guy? Yeah.
He's got this amount of time before he quits. I kind of promote the audience because it came to a point where they just weren't laughing at anything. And so I said to the audience, look, we cannot keep up this pace. So I'm gonna drop a cog. I'm going to tell you a longer story. It's not as funny, but it's got some interesting pathos in it. So let's see how we get on. And they just started booing. And then I said, look, I'm not going to get off unless you all stand up and shout, get off. And everyone stood up apart from two people. So I ploughed on.
So then you had to stay.
Yeah. And then I think I managed to do an encore.
Incredible.
The confab went back on, And I said, bring me back on. So he did. And so that it was just a murderous mess. Like they were,
as a joke, as you left, yeah. You said to the compere, get me back on for an encore.
Yeah, and I remember having to be smuggled out of the back of a similar gig in Camden for sort of like accidentally upsetting a Hindu, if I'm honest. Not accidentally upsetting, just explaining to the Hindu, because what had happened was this Hindu had sort of taken control of the room totally. They were at the front, they were spoiling things. They were genuinely spoiling it. And I said to them, and I was watching the dynamics of the table, and what was happening was that the bride to be was controlling the whole thing, and nobody would laugh unless she laughed. And everybody, all her bride, what they call hens, were sort of looking at her for permission to laugh. And then there'd be like auxiliary chats would break out based on the subject matter of what's been said. So it was just unplayable and unnecessary and horrible. And I basically went on and explained that's what they were doing. And the reason they're doing it is because you're here on your hen night, and that's fair enough, but your hen night is connected to your wedding, and your wedding is your day. No one's denying that. Your wedding is your special day, and you can wear what you want and everything. But we are removed. This isn't your... In her head, in all their minds, this was an extension of the wedding. This was her special comedy show. And so I had to explain that it wasn't, which, you know, didn't sort of go down that well. Everybody else was absolutely fine with it. But apparently they sort of chased after me, and I had to be smuggled out of a back door, which is a door I still don't know where it is. I just sort of emerged in Camden Lock.
Yeah.
Going, how did that even... I don't even... Like, some sort of weird coal chute that I was sort of bundled into.
So this is Tom. What a voice. My God, this one was an absolute pleasure to listen back to, not just because of the many varied, interesting things Tom has to say, but my God, his voice is just amazing, isn't it? We're going to be talking more about truth and comedy and the responsibility of the artist, as well as some really fascinating stuff about the relationship between Tom's club and theatre comedy. Theatre comedy, not really a genre, but you know what I mean. And just the authorship, really, the principles of how he makes what he makes. So that's all to come. Just to quickly plug some upcoming shows. On the 3rd of June, I'm doing a preview with David Trent, brilliant, shouty, mental, video-based David Trent. On the 3rd of June, that's in Twickenham. You can get details by searching Scarecrow Comedy on Facebook. So 3rd of June in Twickenham for that. The 10th of June, there's a preview with John Hastings, a great Canadian comedian. That's at the Harrison, which is a pub near Euston in London. Sorry, a lot of these are London. There's some others in July coming up, which I'll tell you about. Another episode, which I've got some a few more out of London. But that's the 10th of June in the Harrison. The 18th of June in the Pleasance in London in Caledonia Road. That's just me on my own doing a preview. Do come to that if you'd like. I'm really excited about the state of my show after 15 shows in New Zealand now. I'm back in the UK now, but I've got plenty more Kiwi-based guests that I recorded over there still to come. But yeah, 15 or 16 shows in New Zealand, and it's sort of inconceivable to me, really, that I've never done that before. Before going to Edinburgh, I actually had like a serious run of shows somewhere where you can do it every night and then come off and listen to it and write all day and then go back on. So that was great. I'm talking nonsense now because I'm so terrifically jet lagged. Anyway, the 6th of July, finally for now, at the ARG Festival. That's the Actually Rather Good Festival, that is curated by our very own James Peggs Lowy. The Garage in Highbury in London is where that's happening on the 6th, on the 5th and 6th of July, the Saturday and Sunday. And that is something like 40 Edinburgh previews all day with compares, and it's going to be bananas. I'm on the Sunday. I forget who else is on, but he's got loads. I mean, anyone... He's got some incredible acts on. So anyone in their right mind wants to get along to that. The 6th of July, then details there, ArgComFest. That's argcomfest.com. Also, if you've got kids, I'm doing some comedy for kids at the Underbelly on South Bank. The Underbelly? Underbelly? One of those. I forget which is which. On the South Bank, in London, that's the 7th of June at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I don't know who else is on the bill, but I've seen it and I'm excited about it. So if you've got kids, bring them along to that. A couple of emails and tweets from listeners now. Thanks to Ms. London on Twitter, who pointed out that Sam Wills, otherwise known as Tape Face, Boy with Tape on His Face, was actually my first Kiwi guest, contrary to what I'd said on the show regarding Ben Hurley. And that's true, but Sam Wills doesn't count because he's a carny. So where he's really from is the street, man. But thanks for correcting me. And someone else called Trevor Feelgood, lovely name Trevor, has suggested Comedians Comedian merchandise. A couple of people have suggested bits and bobs. And Trevor's suggestion is a T-shirt that says, "I am happy with my place within the comedy industry." I really like that idea. That's very sweet. Possibly we could do a series of those with other T-shirts saying things like, "I am incensed with my lack of progression within the comedy industry." Or another one saying, "I will just have to accept my place within the comedy industry." More ideas, if you'd like, tweet me at ComComPod. Email me info@comedianscomedian.com. Thank you, everyone, for your donations. Do take a second, if you'd like, to click on the PayPal button at comedianscomedian.com if you'd like to support the show. I do receive maybe half of those little messages that you can send alongside the PayPal donation, and about half of them get cut off mid-message for some reason. Don't know what's happening there, but apologies if I haven't responded to something you've asked me. That might be what's going on. But thank you to all of you. And do feel free, if you've enjoyed the show, simply reach into your pocket, take out a donation, however big, however small, whatever you think the show is worth, fold it up neatly and post it to me through the internet. Maybe you could send me the cost of a sandwich, or a nice bottle of wine, or a shit bottle of wine, or a car. Whatever you think would best express your appreciation. So thank you to everyone that has. That's all for now. Let's get back to Tom Wrigglesworth.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
When you play those kind of gigs, do you have kind of, do you have recovery material? Do you have sort of like, I've got this in my back pocket, I'm going to start trying to do the stuff that interests me, and if it starts going south, I'll fall back on this old routine?
Yeah, a little bit. I'll try and make up a battle plan before I go on and just think, well, I'm probably going to do this, this and this.
Okay. And what are your, what's one of your, let's look at the difference between one of your, with examples, if you can muster them, let's look at the difference between like a signature routine of yours that you would do in the best circumstances and your fireproof get me out of trouble stuff and where they came from and how they evolved. Like, what's your favourite bit of material to do at the moment? If you had to do a five at a gala,
yeah,
all bets are off, and you want to show the best of you, what bit would that be at the moment?
I'd do a true story of a posh dinner party that I went to.
The Coburn thing?
Yes, it's got that in it if I want it to.
Yes, of course. Okay.
But it probably would have that in it. It would have that in it. And it's got the posh people talking, and it's got sort of characterisation. It's got silly voices. It's got silly voices. It alludes to the C word, but I don't even say it.
Yes.
And it's got jokes about wine.
Okay. And what is it that you're proud of? What is it that would make you select that as your trademark bit?
I don't know. I just really like I think it has got, because it has got funny voices, which is...
You're very good at funny voices as well, actually.
Well, thanks very much.
You really get the most out of your...
Yeah. I've only got a few. I can't do many. But anyway, these ones. He's got funny voices. Always funny. It's a little bit sort of surreal. Or it's certainly, it's like a cartoon. There's cartoon elements to it. And then, probably, like, a good as example as I'll ever do anyway of observational about like wine bottles, just being honest and saying that this is really cheap and you should only drink it when you're drunk.
Yes.
Or
yes,
don't
yes.
don't open this if you're already pissed.
Yes.
That's what you should say.
That's it. Really yeah, that's a nice
wine bottle. Yeah. Because that's with everyone's known that quandary of like, right, it's 3 o'clock, let's have the shit stuff.
Yeah.
Because we won't drink this. Or if you've got a nice wine, I will say to the wife, this wine was £10 or £15. Don't open it if you're already pissed. There seems so little point in wasting it. So people really respond to that. It feels like one of those, you know, good examples of observational comedy where the audience like go, oh yeah, definitely. We mm-hmm. all do that and no one talks about it. And
yes.
Like you sort of strike gold.
And yeah, absolutely. There's kind of a badge of honour, isn't it? Almost that you go, nailed it. Observed that, got it. I was first. That, I got the thing.
Yeah.
So in comparison, what would be like a fallback? Or not even a fallback, but you'd plan for a tough gig and you'd go, right, well, I'm definitely going to do that one.
I've got routines about teabagging, which tend to appeal to, you know, rooms that you'd describe as sort of tough. Or, like, when I went to see a sex show, probably quite rude.
Oh, the glasses.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
The glasses and the contact lens. Yeah. I mean, just sort of put more dirty stuff, I guess. I haven't really got any other plan, though. Like, if it's going to be hard. I mean, I'm quite good at gently imploding and referring to the situation, you know, sort of third, and pulling myself out of it.
Yes.
Death. Or I just take questions, or I wait until I get heckled, and then I play with that.
Okay.
And then...
That's an interesting strategy. That's not something that comes up in these very often.
Yeah, I've got quite a nice line at the moment.
Go on.
Where I'll get heckled, and usually I'm very much of the persuasion these days. If someone heckles me, I'm really interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're being a bit of a dick, then obviously I'll try and brush it under the carpet and carry on. But if I've got to make a snap decision, if me pursuing this heckle will be funnier than the material I'm about to do is going to be perceived, I've got to pick the funniest path.
That is admirably unprecious.
Yeah, that's what I try and do. And you'll annoy everybody. You'll annoy some people in every situation, because there'll be some people going, we were listening to that. And I've got a hand on heart going, yeah, but it wouldn't have been as funny as what I did, I think. And I was the one who had to make that call. So you've got to sort of go, no, I'm going to ignore it and do my material. My material's funnier than how this will end.
Okay.
Or my material's not as funny as this.
Yes.
This is going to look more impressive. It's going to look more engaging. It's going to make people laugh more. So do that.
And when you just, let's just kind of digress, stay with heckles for a minute. Do you have systems? Do you have processes that you use in order to emerge victorious? Are you going in? What's your toolkit when someone heckles you?
My toolkit is being nice.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really nice to hecklers. I'll try and understand what they mean, because usually they don't know themselves. So my heckle toolkit is politeness and a machine that gives them enough rope to hang themselves, like a sort of fishing wire.
Okay, I've got to explain that. What I mean, that's a lovely image, but what does that mean in real terms? How do you do that?
You sort of. I can't think of any sort of prime examples, but you ask them to expand on what they meant.
Mm-hmm.
And usually there's a massive logical flaw, or you can comedically put it into a massive logical flaw and then explain why they were wrong. But what I do now is which I really love doing, is if I get any sort of heckle. And it really, and the other thing is, of course, is how you are being perceived by the audience at that point. So if the heckle is out of place, I love it, because now the rest of the audience is going to just revel in your takedown of this heckler. So I'll get a heckle, and then I'll get him to say something else, and then I'll have him to say two things, and then I pretend that he is a new heckler and we should be celebrating this man's first
gig
as a heckler. And it's, you know, it's so exciting, because sometimes hecklers are really good, but, you know, we've all seen great hecklers, but they're not born overnight. These good hecklers, they have to work the clubs like comedians do.
Yeah.
So we've obviously got a new heckler. And then I just sort of talked through his day of being nervous at work because it's,
that's lovely.
He's got his first gig tonight as a heckler.
That's lovely.
And his boss is there. And he sort of, before the gig, is nervously going through his heckles. And someone's saying to him, like, hopefully you've planned these heckles, right? You can't just heckle. You need to have planned it, right? Comedians are really good at this. So he's the guy normally, like, I'll have him just read out his planned heckles, which are, of course, the two things that he taught.
Yes, yes, lovely.
We've now, when stripped of all their bile and poison and...
And spontaneity.
Yeah, and spontaneity, yeah. Just look absurd. And whatever they say will always look like... And I, at that moment, I've never felt more... I appear to be walking on water.
Yes.
That's how it feels like. The audience are going, how is he... How have you done that? And it, totally scripted. I just needed two... marks from him, so I just needed one and then I'll get him to say another and then we're off, and the audience, it appears that I've made it all up on the spot, and then at the end of that people are like, that will probably be funnier than the material I was
sure
doing at the time,
sure.
So I'll then,
and still satisfying because it is still something it's you've still written material. You're not just I'll, giving up your gig in order to just
and then if that, all that works, you can then go, right, upon it, where were we? And you can pick up, because you've usually won it back. So it's a great sort of dynamic sport, isn't it, stand-up? You're never quite sure where you stand. You're never quite sure what... How well anything's going to go. So it's funny.
So with just, let's pursue that line of things being scripted, or like the appearance of... the appearance of improvisation.
Pseudo-ad-libs,
if you like, yeah. I mean, well, it seems like the logical endpoint of that is your scripted stories.
Yeah.
Now, you... I'm wrong to say that. I'm not suggesting that they appear to be ad-libbed, but I'm interested in this idea of truth, because you're well-known for... you're well-known for story shows since... I mean, I guess the first one I'm thinking of is the Richard Branson... one,
yeah,
which I was to confess I never saw, but if you could just explain the premise of that for our
premise
audience.
Was I would, as the show premise was that I would start the show writing a letter, sat at a desk with a train set going around, writing a letter to Richard Branson and saying, dear Richard, I'm angry about what happened, and then a couple of jokes about his name, I think, and then I'll say, let me explain what happened, and I'll stand up and then I'll tell this story. And there was an old woman on a train, basically, who had to pay loads of money. I had a whip round, got all the money back. By the time I got to Euston, the police were waiting to arrest me.
For begging on the train.
Yeah,
so begging, in was,
the
yeah.
charge was the begging, yeah. And then...
And this is a true story that actually happened. Yeah.
And then in the show, I did it so... Which was also true. I got released by the police, having been arrested... They let me go. I went home, had a nap. When I woke up from the nap, which was true, there was a voicemail, also true. And the voicemail I then play to the audience. And that voicemail was from the old woman's daughter, which was true. I just re-recorded it. And that voicemail had callbacks to all the jokes.
So all of the things happened except the voicemail that you played back on the night of your show was fake. You'd written it and had an actress record it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it tied up any loose ends that I'd not tied up. Okay. It was tied up by this voicemail. And then when the voicemail was playing, I slipped back behind the desk and then the spotlight would come back up and I'd be there going, so Richard, that's what happened, blah, 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 and sign off like that. That was how it was sort of theatrically done.
I've got loads of questions about that. Let's start with the kind of the mechanics of it. I think of that as being a show that put you on the map in a way that you were previously a respected club comic, and that really made waves. Is that right? Am I right?
Yeah.
I mean, the publicity must have been incredible because of the genuine human interest story. Publicity. It's like, this guy's Robin Hood.
Yeah, free publicity.
And then you were able to back it up, unlike, we all know people who've done publicity stunts and then taken a show to Edinburgh and
with a sketchy 40 minutes.
Well, exactly, and some support acts.
I was very proud of it by the end. And because it was nice, because, like, it was the perfect... One thing about it that I liked was it started with me getting on the train and kind of finished with me getting off it. It was just one train journey, and obviously span off into asides. And there, but so all the characters were contained on the train. There was a lawyer, the old woman, the ticket inspector, a group of Mancunian women, and they were all real. I mean, the thing is, they weren't real. They weren't actually on that train. They were on different train journeys I've had in my life.
Okay.
Is the truth of it. Well, the lawyer was there, because that was one of the funniest bits. There was loads of really funny bits, like, that were true. One of which, for example, was that the police got me in Euston because I approached them.
Right.
They were looking for a beggar, and I had to go up to them.
So, hello there. Say hello. I'm in my cravat and shirt. Yeah.
I know this is weird, but I'm the beggar. And they were like, are you the beggar? Right. Well, it was this guy then. And I'd along the way, I'd picked up a lawyer who was
incredible.
On his way.
Okay.
I said, this is my legal representative. So, like, I remember one joke I really liked saying that. How good a beggar would you have to be if you could afford
a permanent lawyer on standby to follow you around?
A wingman of a legal, yes. legal wingman. It was so funny. And that was kind of true. He was there. He'd found out what happened on the train, and he was like, well, I'll make sure
Amazing.
The police, you know, treat you.
So did you, when you were writing that show, did you start off writing a sort of just the fact version? And then populate it with things that were true, as you say, but from other situations? Or did you go, I'm going to tell this story from the off, and I'm just going to flesh it out and make it all about, a bigger picture?
Yeah, well, I knew the ending. I mean, it was a matter of sort of putting it into a show presentable format, which I liked having the letter. So it started off writing the letter and finished. Yeah, but so the end of it, I'd put this letter in an envelope and walk off. So I'd written the letter. The whole show is the writing of a letter. So I knew the ending, and then obviously the story itself is fairly contained. And then it was just, it was fleshing it out with, like, other characters. I needed other characters. I needed little side spins of stand-up to flesh out the hour, basically, or to give, resonance to other bits.
And you deliver it, you deliver the show at face value as if all of the elements of it are true.
Yeah.
And do you think the audience, when the lady comes in and does callbacks to all the stuff,
did you
feel at the time that the audience were kind of going, oh, I get it, this is clever, he's recorded a version? Or did you think
they
were taking
it
at face value?
They thought it was real. And it wasn't far off.
Sure.
Like, for example, the real one said, hiya, Tom, you don't know me, but you've just helped my mum on the train. And I used that. I used that same line, I'm sure. And I got Diane Morgan to record it, as to just pretend to be a 50-year-old woman, and here's the script. And I recorded it in my flat, and she was in her flat. I recorded it over the phone.
Yeah.
Because it was a voicemail anyway.
Perfect.
But I think we re-recorded it. When I did it on tour, it was a bit hissy. Mm-hmm. So I re-recorded it with her. Anyway, it was the same script. But so it's the same. It started off the same, saying, hi, Tom, you don't know me. But then I just referred to what the old woman was doing, and she was doing something with it was something really sort of heartstring pulling. She was playing with the grandchildren or something, with giving them chocolate, which I'd referred to earlier. So it sounded like it could totally be true.
Yes, okay.
It absolutely sounded like it could be true. You would not, and a lot of people would have, I think, quite rightly thought, that's real, and he's just written a stand-up about it.
Hmm.
It would have been 50-50 at best whether you'd have gone, what did he do first here? Did he? Is that a real voicemail, and he put a stand-up in? Because the stand-up wasn't, like it wasn't vital, it wasn't amazingly funny, it was just cheeky little asides to sort of backward engineer the callback.
Mm.
But it made it all sort of resonate and complete. Rather than someone who might have thought, which was the truth, I wrote it, and then I wrote it with view to making up the voicemail, so it's both happened at the same time.
Okay,
I made all of it up, but I made it up with view for it to sound, of course, real.
And did you find you were? It sounds to me like the sort of thing you'd go, right, I'm going to write this show today, sit down and bang it all out in 8 hours because it all happened, and you had. I mean, that's the easiest stuff I've ever written, is story stuff about a particular thing that already happened that I've described to lots of my mates in the pub, and go, well, I know the structure of this because I've said it. And then you write down, you sit down, write it all out and go, well, it's probably I can expand on that, and that. I mean, did that show sort of, did you come out of it going, and I don't mean to denigrate any hard work that went into it, but did you go, whoa, there we go. Lucky me, something brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, I was a bit lucky. There was only like, apart from the fact it was a very attractive story in that sort of David Goliath.
Yeah, I mean, it could easily have been on Southeastern trains.
Yeah.
And that wouldn't have had anything like the impact of it being Virgin.
I guess so. But there's only really, like, I could tell you the story in 7 minutes, giving you every factual thing.
Sure.
And that would be with jokes. And that would be like an entertaining pub version.
Sure.
So there's an awful lot to write.
Of course,
on top.
Yeah.
There was loads of fitting in and spinning off and working out where callbacks are going to be, working out where, you know, backstories of the character. Oh, God. It took me weeks.
Right.
Weeks and weeks to write.
Okay.
And every time I'd be like, I'm really good at writing something wrong.
Yes.
Like, I'm really good at writing something going, yeah, that's really good, that. And then listening to it back and then thinking about it and then just saying, I'm just going to swap that round. Oh, that's it. It's worked. And I've even tried, I've written a bit and thought, I'm going to swap it around before I even do it. I'm so sure that I've done it wrong. Swap it around, failed.
Swap it back works.
Yeah, I'm just so predisposed.
And when you say listen back, are you going out and recording all your gigs? Is that?
I try to, yeah. Not all of them, but I mean, I'll record ones and then you know, crushingly listen back.
This is upsetting, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
The ones that you thought were deaths, you were never as bad as that. The one that you thought were killer were never as good as you remember. Yeah. It's awful, isn't it?
Yeah. And, yeah, it's hard.
So your writing, what does your writing environment look like? I can imagine you in a book-lined study.
I wrote that one in, I've got a spare room, and I wrote it in there, I remember, with that. Oh no, I wrote half of it in there, half of it on the kitchen worktop. I really liked it because we just knocked the wall down in the, we've got a kitchen and living room, and we knocked the wall down in between, me and the wife did, one day. Because I promised to take her on holiday, and we'd done everything right. Like, book no gigs, we're going on holiday, we're having a proper holiday. She complained. So I did, and then it got really close, and we'd saved up £1,000 to go on holiday, and as we got closer, we didn't care where we went. We were just like, no kids, no real drive to go anywhere. We just want to go on holiday, and it was, I think it was, I can't remember what time of year it was, but anyway, it was funny. As the time neared, as the holiday approached, it became bafflingly clear that flights were going up in price exponentially, to the point where, like, a week before we were due to go, it was £250 per flight per person anywhere out of the country. So that was like all our money gone, just getting two of us out and in again. So we're like, well, what's happened? It was school holidays, wasn't it? We just happened to childless idiots.
Let's go away on December 31st.
Yeah. Fool. Yeah, it was half term or something.
Yeah.
So I said, right, well, we can't. I mean, this is, no, it's not happening. We'll have a DIY holiday. I'll do all the jobs that I said I'd do. And one of them was to knock the wall down. So we did. It was great. We had a week where we knocked the wall down. It was great. We built up a kitchen unit, worktop, kitchen unit, shelves, it's wonderful, lights, plugs, everything. We did it all ourselves. It took us nearly a week working like 8 hours a day and just being knackered at the end. It's like having a proper job. It's great. And I wrote it on there because it was really nice being in the kitchen and looking across the living room out of the balcony, and you could like put the laptop on there. And I built it for tall people, so it's higher than a normal kitchen worktop.
The wife is tall as well.
The wife is tall, yeah. Scandinavian. The wife, not the worktop. No, mind you, the wood is actually Scandinavian. And it'd be nice to write on there because then you could just sort of walk around into the living room and sort of try out what you just said in the space of the living room. And I've just been sort of doing laps. So I'd walk into the living room, sort of say it, and then walk back into the kitchen, type it out again, walk back into, just do laps. I quite like writing like that. But iPhones are really useful for taking notes. You know, my iPhone is full of sentences that may or may not turn into bits. Probably not, like, you know, but
Sentences. Angles, or yeah, premises, both. All those sorts of things.
Yeah. And sometimes I don't write down enough for it to be unpickable later. So I'll just go, what does snooker on ice really mean? You know, when talking about economics, I can't think how I was trying to... Other times they handy, but I mean, the point is, it's so annoying because I'm in a swimming pool and I'll think of something that I have to write this down.
Start clawing it into your hand using your nail.
I've got that before. I've pulled over on motorways.
Yeah.
Got out of swimming pools, you know, appeared rude at funerals. Loads of times. I've got to write this down because I know I'll forget it and it will be gone forever. I've done that so many. I shudder to think. Like, at least an Edinburgh show's worth of ideas I've just gone, I didn't write it down, I remember it.
Yeah.
Didn't.
Can we follow the process of you turning one of those notes into a bit? Can you think of an example from the last show or from something, or something you're working on at the moment, if you're writing?
Yeah, well, this dinner party thing is like the cornerstone of this show I'm doing now. The funniest bit, it's a cornerstone of the show, really. It, this show I'm doing now, it's me at a dinner, and it was a true story. I was at this posh charity dinner. I was sat next to Christine Hamilton. Lulu, my wife, was sat next to Ian Duncan Smith. And what happened there blew my mind because, so I was sat next to Christine Hamilton, and I was sat next to another really posh man. But Lulu had been told not to talk politics with Ian Duncan Smith on the grounds that you won't win.
Told by whom?
Everybody.
Okay.
Everybody. Like, because we knew who we were going to sit next to.
And so you'd done your research beforehand?
Well, the organisers had sort of promised us that we'd sit next to someone interesting. So we were sat, not we weren't sat together, meanwhile. I was sat next to Christine Hammers and she was sat next to Ian Duncan Smith. It was quite a coup, really. We were quite lucky. I know, well...
Yeah, sure. From the point of view of narrative of one's life.
Public figures.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a very, very sort of upper class event. You know, you're going to get a certain type of A-lister there. So Duncan Smith was kind of the middle of the tea towel. if you'd make a tea, I always like making. Imagine any event as a tea towel. It would be in the middle.
I'm struggling to envisage the kind of tea towel.
Like if
you
had a tea towel of a town,
mm-hmm.
Like if you had a tea towel of London, then
gotcha.
St Paul would be in the middle, probably.
I understand.
And
okay.
The Shard
yeah.
and the Westminster, whatever. what would be in the middle of the tea towel?
Okay.
The main, like a Star Wars poster. Who would be?
Yes. Yes. Who gets the foreground? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then obviously you've got auxiliary characters. Around,
sure. So. Sure. Sure. okay.
So Ian Duncan Smith, middle of the tea towel. Christine Hamilton. Top left.
Foreboding corner.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Looming present. Sith Lord. she got a bit tipsy and then got political, started arguing politics to Ian Duncan Smith. I didn't know this because I was...
Your wife, this is, not Mrs. Hamilton.
Yeah, 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 no. Christine Hamilton was really nice to me during that whole...
I was on their show in Edinburgh a couple of years ago. They were both charming.
Yeah, she was so charming. She was really excited to do a little speech. I was petrified. And anyway, the wife has a go at Duncan Smith, and he, completely true, pulls out a pamphlet to give to the wife.
Okay.
And it was curved to the shape of his own arse because it had been in the back trouser pocket, right? And Luda came up to me like after the dessert and went, "You won't believe what's happened." She showed me the thing. And I straight away went, "Oh my god!" And like wrote it in the phone and said, "We need to take that home. This might be one of the funniest things I've ever seen. A man moulding his own manifesto in the shape of his own arse,
and then delivering it. Yeah,
just incredible. I was laughing for about a week, and that started with a sort of. That's not a very good example of what you mean, but it still started with that one sort of pinprick moment of like this happened. And then involved padding it out. So I wasn't sat next to the guy I was in the show. I said I was sat next to. I didn't know who he was.
Okay.
So
that's odd because what you're saying is the most unbelievable elements of the story are real.
Yeah.
And actually it's the more mundane things that you've put in, as you've sort of fit them in around the...
Yeah, and I made them up.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
And so character is the Coburn character. Yeah, is fictitious. You just think Coburn's a funny name. You wanted to do some stuff about it.
I have met someone like that.
Yes.
And obviously people do have that surname. But I know who it is. It's one of my parents-in-law. What are they called? Lula's parents. One of them. Mm. One of their friends is very, very, very wealthy.
Gotcha.
Sort of North London. Like, and I remember seeing them like just crapping on with really expensive wine, and they were doing that thing where she appeared to sort of speak with such eloquence, and she's just so verbose and unnecessarily fucking wordy that whatever she said she then sort of inhaled them back in to her nose. And I was just watching this, I'd sort of lost, I didn't know what she was talking about, it was way too intellectual, and I didn't get it. So all I could see were the words coming out and then being sucked back up. And so I just decided, like, that was that. That went in the phone. So, I mean, in this situation, when I'd got this sort of Ars Bent thing, the manifesto from Ian Duncan Smith, it's then a matter of going through the phone of what other funny situations you can add into this thing. So I made him sit next to me. But there was a really posh man sat next to me. Like, he was kind of like Tim Nice but Dim. He was staggeringly wealthy but stupid.
When you're populating a stand-up story like that with people, it sort of feels like fair game to add whoever you want, because that's what stand-up is, isn't it? This sort of the smoke and mirrors of going, this just happened, or, you know, a funny thing happened to me on day X today or whatever. And, you know, you and I'm preoccupied at the moment with this because I'm doing a similar process at the end of the show that I'm writing at the moment, where I'm kind of fudging a couple of, for to me it feels like fudging a couple of occurrences into one thing. That my show's about, partially about children. There are a number of children in my life, nephews, godchildren, my girlfriend's nephews and nieces, and I'm slightly using them as interchangeable in order to tell a wider story about my reaction to children. Yeah. Well, you say, of course, but to me it feels wrong. Really? And I'm having a sort of fight against an instinct of going, No, I want to, you know, because in my head they're very different, specific humans, and I'm just kind of, I feel like I'm exploiting them slightly by going, by pretending it was Charlie that fell off the wall and not Tom. Do you mean because they're from two different families? Do you have any issue?
No. I have no issue with doing that.
Not even when, in the case of your grandfather show, The Utterly at Odds with the Universe, there is real recording, I think I'm right in saying, is there real recording of your grandfather and you speaking? And then at the end of the show, there's recording of an actor playing your grandfather.
Well, we don't want to give away too much, do we? But and people come up to me all the time and say, are those recordings, you know, for the purposes of the listeners of this podcast, the show starts with me interviewing my granddad when I was little. And the show ends with him interviewing me without me being there, essentially. And people say, were those tapes real? What was? And then I'll say, do you really, really, really want to know? And they'll go, no, I don't.
Yeah.
So people don't normally want to know
whether
it was.
Because that's part of the buying into the show process.
Yeah, yeah. So it was.
And because I guess they don't want to hear you say, you know, they don't. And I'm not saying either way, but they don't want to hear you say, for example, no, they're not, and then walk away with their dreams crushed.
But when you think about it, it's obvious what the truth is, and that is, well, I'll give it away now, I don't mind. If you really don't want to know, just don't listen.
You just press pause now. And when you unpause, we'll still be having this conversation.
Yeah, that's how pause works, isn't it? The truth of it was, I found a box of tapes that was me interviewing my granddad, but they were hissy old cassettes that had been in a dusty box. So I copied them into the computer, and whatever audio effect I could try and EQ in and noise gating and anything, they still sounded awful. The headphones were sort of fine, but put it through a big PA and you just this massive hiss. Or if you could took the hiss out, you took out all the meat of the voice, so everyone just sounded like they were on a phone. So they were just unplayable, and they were crash edited into other moments that we were recording, so, you know, it was very choppy. But I replicated that. So I basically got my friend, who's my age, I've known for years and years, he's got a 7-year-old son called Paddy, and he's very... And he's born and bred in Sheffield. And he's got a bit of a lisp. So he sounds just, it sounds exactly like my tapes or the original ones. It's unbelievable. And then my mate, Paddy's dad, his dad, so Paddy's granddad. So we got a real granddad and grandson from Sheffield. Which age-wise would have been absolutely spot on. And it sounded, so the first bit was just a re-recording, basically, of the original. They were just re-recordings, because I was taking lines off the original tape. I was saying to Paddy, say this. And they ad-libbed a bit, and I can't remember what ad-libs. It's only very brief anyway. There's only about sort of six sentences each, but out of those six, four of them were lifted off the other one.
So is this a case of this process was kind of authentic enough for you, given the circumstances? There were real tapes.
Yeah.
Would you feel differently? Would you ever do a show, say, where, I don't know, imagine hypothetically you did a sequel to this show and you, or not even a sequel, what am I going to say? Hypothetically, would you do a show where you presented stuff which had not had any basis in fact? You just thought, oh, it's a good idea, and you could record them. Obviously, you've proved that you could record something that looked amazing like that. Would that feel like that you're... Would it feel dishonest somehow? Would you feel like, no, it's complete... I'm not trying to lead you in either direction. No, would you feel like, look, this is fiction, the stand-up contains elements of truth, and fictionalising truth is something that we're allowed to?
I know a few people... well, I'll answer that in a second. So the first tapes, let's remember, in this show I'm doing, are like digital remasters of the originals. Because the originals, it would have sounded awful. It would have just sounded terrible. So anybody that...
Oh, so by digital remasters, you mean rebuilt with access?
He's in redone with a different child and his granddad. Prompted by me to sound like the original. And then I crash edited in clips from Band-Aid and whatever to sound like it was in the mid-80s, which is how the tape sounded anyway.
Absolutely, so and very successful, yes.
Very like authentic. And then the last tape is the same, my mate's dad, Jeff, who is a complete work of fiction. And I'd like to think I actually changed a bit of the show so people would know it was fiction, because
that's interesting. Because why?
Well, I didn't want to freak people out, and like in the train story, it follows a very similar template to the train story, with and the voicemail at the end of the train story is the equivalent of the cassette tape interview at the end of this story. Now, with the train story, I absolutely wanted people to believe that the voicemail was real at the end. Right. And I have no shame in saying, well, the only reason I didn't use a real one is because it had fallen off my phone. So I kind of had to. And then I just sewed in a couple more callbacks to tidy it up. But that's called theatre, isn't it? But I would... people would say, was the voicemail real? And I'd say, well, no, but it was based on... I'd expect people to believe it was real. It's up to them if they don't. It's totally up to them. I don't mind. But with this one, I wanted people to... I didn't want people to think it was definitely real. People still do, but I try to, like... There's so many callbacks in it that my belief is this is just a experiment in what would happen if I could... If the last interview with my granddad took place, that... The show's all about the last interview, so it's just more like a fantasy. The last tape is like...
And it's important to you that they know that it's fantasy.
Yeah, I've pointed to it enough that this is clearly a sort of extrapolated dream.
Gotcha.
Based on everything I've told you up to now. Because the callbacks are so, like, signposted.
Sure.
That for this to be real is insane. Like there's no way that is this real, and he wrote everything up to it. Now, oh, that's great. He's explored the idea of that. But hopefully, you're so swept up with the sentimental style of the story and everything that, and you want to hear the voicemail that you can suspend disbelief, enjoy it, and probably get a bit quivery lipped and think about God, what would I say if I was doing that? Or what would I want to hear, or what would I say, is how is the reason I think most people sort of end up crying. It's just, you know, I think it's a nice idea, that what you're going to say What would, if you could record a tape before you died for someone, what would you... Amazing. But I don't want people thinking it was real, because that would, I think that would be a slightly unfair manipulation of grief. And I mean, when I did it in Edinburgh once, there was one girl crying so much at the end that I changed the tense, because at the time I was doing it like my granddad was still alive and he dies out of the blue. I mean, people, a lot of people said, no, you shouldn't, you don't need to. Like, after 8 minutes I'm by his bedside. It's not looking good for Gramps. You know what I mean? After eight, well, you should have an idea where this is going to end, right?
Sure.
She freaked me out so much, this girl who was very, very teary, and very upset. Like, upset and angry, actually. Angry, because, and I felt like I'd manipulated grief too much and by pretending that he was alive, and then he dies, and then that tape. And at the time, the tape, I think, the callbacks weren't as well sewn in, so it felt like it could probably be real, and I've just had a go at telling routines that will resonate with it. So it's probably way too, like, raw. And she just lost someone. Obviously, there was a backstory to her, you know, resonated with what I was doing. So she was in bits. I had a very long chat with her in Edinburgh about what I was trying to do and how I... in this case, kind of failed. So I changed a bit of the tenses, which I since sort of play with. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. I mean, it was a spectacular one-off, this. Mm. And there were other elements at play, not just the tense of my granddad is or my granddad was. Mm. And then I had another guy a few weeks later who just came up to me in Edinburgh in bits, a broken man. You're just sobbing. And I sort of hugged him for ages, and then we had a long chat, and then he... basically what happened was his grandma died about 3 months before, and his family, proper Northern England family, they just like completely emotionally chastised. They'd not talked about any of the passing of their, you know, a matriarchal figure, so no one had really discussed it, and so whatever grief and stuff was just welling up inside him, this show had just popped. And so it was a gibbering wreck, and then he sent me a brilliant email thanking me for the sort of cathartic nature of it. But it's been really hard and emotional writing it, and performing it has been the case as well. But you can't play with grief fast and loose. You can't have people. It's got to be safe, right? It's got to be a safe exit. Like, so when people are crying at the end, they know. I want them to cry knowing it's not real. I'm going to let myself think it's real so I can cry. And I know it's not real. And, you know, this is just, oh, isn't it lovely? And like, oh, we're laughing and crying. It's mad. This is value for money. That's kind of what I want people to feel. Not like, this is brutal.
Sure. And is this something you can see yourself pursuing? I know you're not going to Edinburgh this year. Do you know what, have you started thinking, because you've been touring this show for a while, have you started thinking what your next show, what your next tour will be about?
No, I'm doing a radio series. I did a radio series about phone calls back to my parents.
Hang ups. Cracking title, good work.
Thanks very much. Tom Wigglesworth's Hang Ups, that's the title. And I'm going to do another series, I'm writing another series basically. I should be writing it now. If James Kettle hears this, he's going to be furious. Because he knows I should be sending him stuff. So I'm doing that in the autumn. That's being recorded in the autumn. And, I mean, it's... I've also got, like... I mean, for example, like, things... It comes a point where you just, like... You made me think of it earlier. Like, when I was on the train, that time I was on the train, right, I thought, oh, I'm just going to leave it. An old woman had been done over. Whatever happens all the time. And then part of me did feel a sort of massive pang of public duty when I realised that if everybody put a quid in, we would solve this, but there would be no problem. Somebody's got to tell everybody. So as a public speaker, I have to... if I don't do this, this is the equivalent of a midwife just walking past a pregnant woman in difficulty saying, sorry, love, it's my day off. You know, you cannot do that. You're totally duty-bound on every level to step in. So I stepped in.
Is there a comedian on board?
Yeah. And that was in my mind of like, I'm just going to push this. I'm going to push it. And even when I was like being told off by the guard. I was, and I'm just going to push it as far as I can just to see what will happen, right? And then and that happened. I wrote that show about it. And then it's the same with the finding of the tapes, really. I found the tapes and then... Well, that sort of took care of itself. But what's interesting, that one, I'm not going to Edinburgh because I'm sort of... I've got a weird bet on that I'm trying to get... I've got a doppelganger who plays American football. And I'm trying to get him to try stand-up and maybe a quarterback. It's a ludicrous proposition, but...
For you more than him, one might imagine.
Yeah. I know. I mean, he could be quite good, right? I will definitely be shit. He could just get someone really good to write 5 minutes and nail it. And
you want him to make him do his own material as well?
Well, I don't know about that.
Yeah, right? Sure. But, okay.
I mean, whatever, wherever it comes from.
Like, yeah.
Whatever, just do 5 minutes and I'll be a... That's the idea. I made this little video of it. Of, I mean, this all it was I got back in one day and we're making roast chicken and my Twitter feed started to light up with, oh my God, Aaron Rodgers, this American footballer, is moonlighting on some science program. I was doing this science program and there was a screen grab of me and him and we kind of looked the same, but not really. And then I watched it just go a bit mad on Twitter. And I was going, what is this? Who is it? So we're looking into who he was. If you Aaron Rodgers, image search. You'll think...
I'm on it.
No,
I'm all over it.
And then
you'll
go,
live.
Oh, yes, he does.
Aaron with two A's.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Aaron Rodgers. Go, keep telling me the story while I just miss the background. See if I can...
Is that from here? Oh, no, I don't think I've read that one.
No, that's... What? Anything like
no,
you?
Image search shop. That's a corporate clean cut one. That's not the case.
Okay.
Okay.
Keep going. So the plan is the Twitter feed lit up.
Yeah, Twitter feed lit up. I waded in and posted a sort of stand up clip with him on.
Okay.
No, with me on. Sorry, the stand up clip for me. And then.
Oh yeah. Okay.
There you go. There you
go. Yeah.
But yeah. I mean, but seriously, people in Green Bay, Wisconsin, they can't believe it. Like, I mean,
incredible.
I've got an angle. It needs to be one angle.
Yes.
I look just like him.
Okay.
So I made. So it's just a point of like, right, how can we kick this as far as possible? This is a weird opportunity, like, and obviously regret is crushing. So. I was touring at the time, it was so busy, but I made a video called Where Do You Think You're From? Which is, a genealogical
yes.
look back at
yes, okay.
possibly. It's on YouTube called Where Do You Think You're From? Aaron okay. Rodgers. And I don't know what's going to happen.
That's how you've approached him, by putting a YouTube video.
Yeah,
yes, gotcha.
He follows me on Twitter. He tweeted me.
Okay.
He's an extremely famous American sportsman, but I've got the odd message from him. He's a lovely man, and he's a proper he's a sports hero. He's really good. Like he's broken loads of records and stuff, and he seems so nice. And he had a bit of a difficult start to his career, so he overcame adversity early on. So people just adore him.
Okay.
Quite rightly, he sounds amazing.
Oh, so I can't wait to see what this turns into.
And he's up for a laugh. You know, he doesn't seem precious and weird.
Yeah.
And he seems very, very.
We've got to wrap up, but I want to just before you go, I want to get a couple of things. I'd like to know what you get out of stand up. What is it that drives you to do it? You seem pretty. Confident in yourself, you seem pretty happy. We haven't maybe there aren't any demons, or maybe we haven't sort of struck upon them.
I'm classically the sort of fourth out of five children, really. So,
is that a classic thing?
Well, it's
maybe in the north, Tom.
It's quite, yeah, I think it's quite statistically that comedians are the youngest part of a brood, you might find, because no one listens to them, so they've got to find unique, clever, more. You know, noticeable ways of being listened to.
And is that it for you?
Yeah,
you want
yeah,
to be listened to?
Oh, God, yeah, totally. No one ever listened to me when I was little. Listening that, now, though!
And that. But there are ways to be listened to without being funny.
Yeah. But they've also been taken by older siblings.
Really?
Well, you know, I mean, how are you going to do it then if you're not going to, like, shouting?
No, I mean, in terms of, like, your... I
see.
Like, you know, you could be an actor or a playwriter. I mean, you know, your comedy is sort of leaning towards storytelling now, isn't it? Do you feel you're... Can you see yourself in the future being purely a storyteller, or will it always have a comedy element? And if it does, where does that need to get laughs come from?
Oh, God. I mean, it's just... I like funny people. I like being funny. I like the effect it has on people. I like people when they're laughing. I haven't got any proper uncles, but I've got loads of great uncles. I remember when they were a kid, they were all just hilarious. And I used to love watching. I didn't understand what they were talking about. But these are all on new tapes when I was listening back to them. They were just talking about, like, the price of sugar was such a recurring thing in 1979. So I was far too young to know what was going on. But I remember these parties. I remember them being there, and I remember them showing me card tricks and stuff. And I used to just love when they used to make each other laugh. It was just incredible. So I just think it's a nice... And I don't know if I'm any good. I think I can get a bit better. I think I can be better, but I've always been most impressed with myself when I've made. My only real way of impressing people usually is to make them laugh. Really, I haven't got anything, any other sort of serviceable skills I used to have, but they've all sort of got rusty.
What do you mean? What sort of?
Well, I used to be really good at maths. You see, so when I had a proper job, it was sort of quite mathematically analytical.
Okay. What was it? What was the job?
I was I was in radio engineering, wireless engineering.
Okay.
I couldn't do that anymore. So. I don't know what I'm going to do next. It's funny, like, when I was a 25-year-old stoner and I didn't know what I was going to be doing in 6 months, to be honest with you, I still don't. I have no idea what I want to be.
You were saying the other day you're 38.
38, yeah.
So, I mean, I don't think... Were they your words? Did you say pushing 40? 40 came up. We were talking about both being late
30s.
Probably,
yeah, inevitably, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And are you... Do you have a view of what you might be as a comic when you're mid-40s, late-40s? Do you have a sort of an idea of
My favourite
where
comedian
it can go
was
or
Dave
long?
Allen. Dave Allen's probably my favourite comedian, I think. And he was, you know... I mean, trends have changed, but I think comedy, I like to think so, and I really hope so, for all our sakes, is that it is immune to the pollution of youth. Which has kind of trashed every other art form, right? Like, pop music's no good if you're over 9.
Mm-hmm.
You're too old to perform it, it seems.
I've just had a horrible vision of all of us 30 exactly. years from now all sitting on stools trying to be Dave Allen.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
Your panel shows being full of, like,
yeah,
here all, you know, this is, well, no, I mean, I've just imagined panel shows being full of us old. Do you know what I mean? Like, elderly versus everything just keeps going, and you get panel shows which are like 7 stools and it's 7 Dave Allen type comments.
Yeah, no, I think panel shows and that sort of that televised, edited comedy, controlled, that will be won over by the attraction of youth. And there will be, like, Mock the Week will be just children that have been fed lines because they look so flawless and clothes look great on them. And they'll be just fed by sort of fat, balding men who are reading newspapers and being hilarious, but just saying it through these children. But real stand-up in real clubs, where you have to be real and live, that, I think, is unpenetratable from the toxic thrust of juvenile people. or something like that, you know what I mean? So I don't mind getting old as a comedian. I think there will be. I've still got... The best show is not... I'm not done it yet.
Thanks, Tom.
Oh, you're welcome.
So that was Tom. Thanks to him for coming along. We've got some more Kiwis coming up fresh from the New Zealand International Comedy Festival. Next week, I'll be having a very exciting conversation with Michelle Acourt. I've just been logging that one today, about feminism, authenticity, and the right of audiences to shout back that comes inescapably with the right of comics to free speech. I think that is going to be very exciting episode as well, so do hurry back for that one. Remember, you can get a free trial with Audible, the people that do downloadable audiobooks, and if you'd like to get hold of one of their free month-long trials, you can sign up for it via audible.co.uk/cc for Comedians Comedian. That's audible.co.uk/cc, and that will mean that you can also support this show at the same time. So many thanks if you're planning on doing that. You can donate to the show online, or if you'd like to support it for free, then please just share this podcast with a friend. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. This show was co-produced by Nathan Wood, and I'll speak to you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.